Good afternoon. One of the advantages of living in a republic like this is the freedom of speech granted to every citizen by the Constitution. If you don't like what some town official says or does, it's your privilege to stand up in town meeting or anywhere else and disagree with him. You can also criticize the clergy, the Congress, yes, even the President of the United States, personally or in the press. One president, Andrew Jackson, better known as Old Hickory, was so universally hated up here in New England, he was hissed in public. And when it became known that a wooden statue of Jackson was being carved in Boston as a figurehead for the Frigate Constitution, a lot of citizens were furious. You just can't imagine how incensed they were. The grand and glorious Frigate Constitution, back from her victories over all enemies, was something sacred to Yankees hereabouts. And they'd be blamed if they'd allow the effigy of any living man to grace the bow of that proud ship, let alone the image of that irrational, hot-tempered Southern Democrat, Andrew Jackson. Why, he had defied the Supreme Court. He'd busted up the nation's banking system and brought on a depression. No siree. No face or figure of that fellow was going on Old Ironsides, even if he was President of the United States. Well, that's what the citizens thought. The commandant of the Charlestown Navy Yard had a different idea. Last week, to give a bit of background to this little-known episode in American history, I mentioned that Andrew Jackson was the first president of the United States to adopt the spoil system, meaning that he believed that those who rounded up voters and elected the ticket should be rewarded with good, soft jobs. And as soon as Jackson was elected over the Republican candidate, John Quincy Adams from Massachusetts, political plums were handed out as freely as beans at a Beano game on Saturday night. And for the first time in the nation's history, 500 federal employees were kicked out of office merely because they had voted the Republican ticket. Now, there were, of course, even up here in cold, roast Boston, a few admirers of Jackson. And being good Democrats and anxious to keep their jobs and get others for their friends, they did what they could to keep in good graces. One such individual was the new commandant of the Charlestown Navy Yard, Jesse Duncan Elliott, a hard-fisted, hard-fighting old sea dog who had made quite a name for himself at the Battle of Lake Erie. He was so brusque in his manner and growled so loud and often, the Navy Yard boys nicknamed him Old Bruin. And when he up and named the new dry dock the Jackson Basin, they called him plenty of other things. This new dry dock, a marvelous piece of engineering in charge of Loamy Baldwin, was almost finished. And the first big ship to be overhauled there was the Constitution. To celebrate the event, Elliot invited the president. But a bad cold prevented him from attending, and maybe that was lucky. For Commandant Elliot received a letter which threatened, "Take Jackson's name off that dry dock, or in 48 hours you'll breathe no more." It was signed, "Many North Enders." When the Constitution was launched in 1797, she bore on her bow a large wooden head of Hercules. But during the battle off Tripoli, Hercules was badly riddled by gunfire, so it was removed and a conventional billet head was put up. But when Old Ironsides reached Boston, Commandant Elliot saw a fine chance to honor his idol, Andrew Jackson. Dashing off a rough sketch of the president, in tight-fitting trousers and long flowing cape, he took the sketch to the shop of Mr. Laban S. Beecher, saying, "Beecher, I want you to carve a larger-than-life-size statue of our great President Andrew Jackson. And I'm going to use it as the new figurehead for the Constitution. You'll see by this sketch that I want him bareheaded and holding a scroll with these words, 'The Constitution, it must be preserved.' And while you're about it, Beecher, I'd also like to have you make three small busts of Hull, Bainbridge, and Stuart. I'm going to put them out on the stern. And oh yes, you'd better make Jackson at least 10 feet tall. And I'd like him carved from a single piece of the best pine you can get." Well, before Mr. Beecher had finished carving the Jackson figurehead, a group of gentlemen called and made him a proposition. "If you lend us the key of your shop so we can sneak in after dark and swipe this old Roman, we'll pay you $1,500. Now, this was five times what he'd get for the carving job, but Beecher explained it was a government commission and he'd have to deliver it. Then a few days later, he received a letter which said, "If you will agree never to make another image of Andrew Jackson as long as you live and turn over the one you've just finished for the Navy Department, we'll pay you $10,000. That was an awful temptation. But Beecher couldn't be bought, and he asked Elliot to send a working party to get the figurehead before anything happened to it. It was hoisted to the bow of Old Ironsides and bolted on. And then, to put it mildly, all Hades broke loose. The workers in the yard, the sailors on the ships, the Sons of Liberty, lawyers, ministers, bankers, and businessmen alike, all denounced the Jackson figurehead as an outright disgrace. Thousands of handbills flooded the city of Boston. Listen to this one. 'Free men awake,' it said in big black type, 'or the Constitution will sink. Our president has allowed a colossal figure of his royal self in Roman costume to be placed on all Ironsides. Are you going to stand for the figure of a living landlubber on her bows? Let us nail the flag of the Union to her masthead and let her ride the waves triumphant with none on board save the sons of liberty who have hearts and souls of free men. If any living man be worthy to be so honored, let it be brave Isaac Hull, immortal Stephen Decatur, or our valiant Porter, but never the figure of a tyrant like Andrew Jackson. Another of the handbells read, "Attention, North Enders. Shall this Boston-built ship be thus disgraced without remonstrance? Let this wooden god, this old Roman, which cost the taxpayers $300, be presented to the office holders, who glory in such hero worship. But for God's sake, save the Constitution from this foul disgrace." Now, those were strong words, but they were printed by the thousands and shouted from the housetops, and before long, the Jackson figurehead fiasco had become a crisis of national importance. Naturally, the Navy Department down in Washington asked for an explanation, and Elliot reported as follows, quotes, "All this excitement is due to a small group of narrow-minded politicians. If we remove the figurehead of the president, as the rabble demands, there's no telling what they'll want next." And Washington replied, "Why not put the figurehead on one of the 74s that's moored nearby? And we suggest that you cancel the order for the other three heads you'd planned to put up." But it was too late. Elliot had already affixed the three small busts of Hull, Bainbridge, and Stuart to the stern. But out on the bow, the hated features of 10-foot Jackson loomed bigger than life. But I might add, not for very long. Mindful of the public's revulsion at his act, Elliot posted guards all over the Constitution and ordered sentries to stand by on the other war vessels. He had lights shining all night on the Jackson figurehead, while on the dock a dozen sentinels paced back and forth to prevent sabotage. However, on the morning of July the 3rd, 1834, the guards, sentries, marines, and naval officers stared with unbelieving eyes at old Ironsides. For somehow, sometime in the night, some daring person had sawed off the president's head and carried it away. Instead of indignation at such wanton vandalism on board the most treasured and beloved fighting ship in the American Navy, there was great rejoicing. Toasts were drunk, cheers rent the air, fifes and drums played Yankee Doodle, and you may not believe this, but when word reached Wheeling, Virginia, that Old Hickory's head had been hacked off from the Constitution up in Boston, Massachusetts, all the church bells were rung, as if celebrating some tremendous victory. And in other cities, resolutions were passed approving the act. Now, I don't know how the president felt about all this, but I can tell you what Commodore Elliot reported to his superiors in the Navy Department. His letter, dated Boston, July 3rd, 1834, says in part, "Last night, in spite of the watch I had posted to guard the ship, someone found means to mutilate the statue of Jackson on the bow of the Constitution. At first, I suspected the Marines, but now it seems probable that outsiders concealed themselves aboard the ship during the daytime, and when the storm raged at its highest, accomplished the foul deed and made their escape. Upon learning of the outrage," Elliot continued, "I summoned the woodcarver Beecher and demanded that he give me the names of the parties who had tried to buy the figurehead. This he refused to do, saying he is under a pledge of secrecy." "From this and other circumstances," the report continued, "I am satisfied the head was removed under influence of a bribe. And I'm sorry to say, sir, that I perceive a rather hostile feeling against the continuance of this particular adornment among the highest officials of the party who opposes this administration." He was putting it mildly. 2 days later, Commandant Elliot had a chance to make another report to the Navy Department. "Last night," he wrote, "a second attempt was made to remove the body of the figurehead, but was thwarted by our lookouts. I believe one of the vandals fell in the harbor and was drowned. The others must have escaped by scaling the walls. The dory they used was found, and we have it here at the yard." Honorable Marlon Dickerson, who had just succeeded Levi Woodbury of New Hampshire as Secretary of the Navy, rushed from Washington to Boston to investigate these goings-on. And as the Constitution was due to sail for New York, he ordered Elliot to cover the headless figure with canvas, which Elliot did, but he camouflaged it to resemble a draped American flag. At New York, a new head was fastened to the body with a copper bolt, thereby starting a controversy which hasn't been settled yet and possibly never will be. Well, when the Constitution sailed for France in March 1835 as flagship of the Mediterranean Squadron, the old body of Jackson with a brand new head was at the bow, and it stayed there for 40 years. Eventually, old Ironsides was taken to the Navy Yard in Philadelphia for overhauling. The Jackson figurehead was removed, placed on exhibition, and then sent to the Naval Museum at Annapolis, where it is today. But listen to this. All the time the wooden image of Old Hickory was attracting crowds in Philadelphia and Annapolis, Maryland, another figurehead of Jackson, found in a shop on Commercial Street, Boston, was on exhibition at Willowdale, a small amusement park just outside the city of Lowell. And the man who owned that statue so convinced the agents of Henry Ford, when they called to inspect it in 1925, that it was the original Beecher figurehead from the Constitution, Henry Ford offered $10,000 for the historic relic. The day after Ford's offer appeared in the Boston and Lowell papers, a mystery man drove up in a big black limousine and raised the bid, saying that he wanted the figurehead for his private estate near Boston. It was later learned the so-called mystery man was Max Williams, a wealthy New York collector. And after his death, the figurehead of Jackson came eventually into the possession of the Sewanica Corinthian Yacht Club, which loaned it to the Marine Museum of the City of New York. And you can see it there anytime, 1225th Avenue between 103rd and 104th Streets. Now then, if you should be down in Annapolis, Maryland, you might drop into the Naval Museum there and also see the famous Jackson figurehead from Old Ironsides. And here's a mystery. There are two heads, and there are also two bodies. I want to know where the second body came from. I'm not going to try and solve the mystery of these two controversial carvings in my next broadcast, but I am going to tell about the Cape Cod sea captain, who was clever and daring enough to cut the president's head from the frigate Constitution, and what happened to him when he took it in a canvas bag to Washington, D.C., and tried to give it back to Andrew Jackson. And if any of you have definite information as to which head of Jackson is on what body and where, I sure would like to know about it. Neither the museum in New York nor the museum at Annapolis, Maryland, knows for sure whether or not they have the original figurehead of the Constitution.